Good morning, brothers and sisters. Our topic this morning is a vast one, and the material that I give to you is condensed from a series of classes that I did 6 years ago, maybe almost 7 years ago on this subject. And we have a lot to say, and there's probably a lot that we will indeed leave out. So as we endeavor to do this morning, we'll try to get what I consider to be the salient points of Daniel's fourth beast within the time allotted to us. Now, last night in the readings, we discussed the aspect of the replication of concepts in scriptures, which is indeed very good for us because all of us, I think, you know, are leaky vessels, and we leak as much out as we take in. And Yahweh, recognizing that, presents things to us over and over again, not always in the same fashion, so that, you know, we get the concept right. We finally get it through the repetition. And in the area of prophecy, this also holds true. So therefore, in our subject this morning, Daniel's fourth beast, it's imperative for us to understand that the background or foundation of the chapter that was just read in our hearing, Daniel 7, concerning our time is provided in Daniel chapter 2, with the image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, therefore, there recorded. Although, of course, it's not within the time limit and purpose of this class to detail Nebuchadnezzar's image per se, a familiarity of that image is required if one is to correctly understand Daniel's fourth beast. If you don't understand Daniel 2, you'll never understand properly Daniel 7. Two very important points to be derived from Daniel chapter 2 and the image therein presented are that, one, the image provides an outline of world history from Daniel's time until the end of Gentile times, and that, two, it was revealed by Yahweh to show what would come to pass in the latter days. Two very important features. It is generally understood, and I guess this is like elementary prophecy 101 for most here, generally understood that the image of Nebuchadnezzar depicts the succession of four great kingdoms or empires. Summarized briefly, they are as follows: the head of gold, Babylon; breast and arms of silver, Medo-Persia; belly and thighs of brass, Greece; and, of course, the legs of iron, representing Rome. It is generally understood that the fourth kingdom of the image, which was Rome, was to be divided, inasmuch as there were two legs. Indeed, in 396 A.D., the Roman Empire was divided into two kingdoms, East and West. The Western Empire still had as its capital Rome. The Eastern Empire had Constantinople, or what later became under the Ottoman Turks, Istanbul, as its capital. But then you might ask, what are the feet? He hasn't said anything about the feet. To what time period do the feet apply? Well, if we look at scriptures to see what deity revealed to Daniel, then we can come to a conclusion as to what the feet apply to. Remember that not only did deity reveal to Daniel what Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed, but he also revealed to Daniel the interpretation of the dream. From Daniel 2, we read, "His legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. And then he goes on, Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. Approximately 100 years after the Roman Empire was divided into eastern and western parts, 10 kingdoms appeared in the western part. These kingdoms were the result of what scholars call the Germanic or barbarian invasion of the Western Empire. These 10 kingdoms correspond to the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image. The kingdoms can be enumerated as follows: the Huns, the Vandals, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, the Gepidae, the Lombards, the Franks, the Suevi, the Alans, and the Bavarians. By 475 AD, these 10 kingdoms occupied all of the Western Empire, with the exception of a small part of France. For part of their existence, some of these kingdoms considered themselves an integral part of the Roman Empire. And that is a comment that should not be dismissed lightly. Even though they were originally barbarians, even though they were considered by the Romans to be the lowest of the low, when they came into authority, they considered themselves, as it were, to be Roman. And we'll address the importance of that as we continue this morning. Their kings wished, as it were, to legitimize their authority and government in the eyes of their Roman subjects. They had conquered these people, and they were like saying, look, we're just as civilized as you, as it were. And so the image of the Roman emperor, however weakened he may have been, was at first put on their coinage. After the last Roman emperor ruled in the West, the barbarian kings appropriated the Roman heraldry to themselves as the successors of the legacy of Rome. These kingdoms were not all strong. Their terms of existence were not the same. Yet they shared many characteristics. They all considered themselves to be successors to Rome. They all adopted to a great degree the laws of Rome as their common law. They all submitted, and again we'll address this later on this morning, they all submitted at some time to papal authority. Brother John Thomas in Eureka, and just think about this, how on target Brother Thomas was. In Eureka, he called them a European Commonwealth. Now, how about that for language appropriate to our time here at the end of Gentile times? Thus, an answer to the question, what time period is reflected by the feet and toes, it should be noted that the beginning of the time period represented by the feet and toes is at the decline and fall of the Western Empire, or approximately 450 A.D. to 500 A.D. The termination point is provided by Daniel's interpretation of the dream. The feet and toes are struck by the stone cut without hands and are replaced by a kingdom established by God which shall never be destroyed. Thus, the time period of the feet and toes is ended by their destruction and the establishment of the millennial kingdom. Concerning the toe kingdoms, Brother Thomas wrote in Elpis Israel, quote, these strong and broken toe kingdoms have existed upwards of 13 centuries. Of course, he wrote this in 1848 and afterwards, 1848-68, if you take the fourth edition of Elpis Israel. They are still in being, but not as originally established. And he says this important thing, this the prophecy does not require. End of quote. Nebuchadnezzar's image then provides a very general outline of history from Daniel's time until the establishment of the kingdom of God. The student must bear in mind that Nebuchadnezzar's image does not attempt to outline history to depict what was to transpire in the entire globe from Daniel's time to the time of the end. For example, nothing can be derived from this outline concerning China or Japan or a host of other nations and peoples. The object of prophecy was always to reveal God to men and to keep men with God. For this purpose, prophecy is a witness to God's foreknowledge, both to Jew and Gentile, but it is above all an instrument. And this is the exhortation for today, or this morning at least, but it is above all an instrument in the preparation of a people for Yahweh. It is given primarily for the benefit of those with whom God is working out his purpose of redemption. And in that light, then, you know, what happens to China or Japan in the interim centuries does not matter. Now, so that's Daniel 2 and the basis or the foundation for what we want to consider this morning. So now we come to Daniel 7, as it were. And as was read, you know, we have in Daniel 7 a depiction, as it were, of various beasts, with the last, of course, being this one of our consideration, our focal point, Daniel's fourth beast. Well, it's very clear to the Bible student that the enumeration of the beast in Daniel 7 is but yet another picture of the information given in Daniel 2, as it were. So there is an assignment, a correspondence, if you will, of the beast in Daniel 7 to the kingdoms in Daniel 2. So here we have this aspect of replication, if you will. But why is that? And of course, that's important to understand. There were certain important particulars to be revealed to Daniel and to you and I in connection with the empires and kingdoms of the metallic image of Daniel 2, which could not be suitably expressed through a symbol of the human form. It became necessary, therefore, to introduce other representations. These other representations that would admit of appendages more in harmony with them. And think about it. We see this in everyday life. A lot of times, speaking from the standpoint of view of an American, you know, the actions of the American government are represented by a man that, you know, has a striped top hat, wears a striped garment, you know, and he's called Uncle Sam, as it were, in his symbolic caricature form. Other times, the United States and its actions are represented by an eagle, you know, with a cluster of arrows in one hand and, I don't know, maybe cruise missiles in his other talon, you know. But in the political world, various representations are made by various symbols, as it were. And this is no less true in the biblical symbology that is before us. In other words, in Daniel 2, we have a metallic image of a man. But the history of that man and the various phases of that man, of those kingdoms, could not be adequately represented by, you know, just that image. So, for example, how could we get, as it were, the dreadful and terrible history of Rome, you know, just from the mental image of two legs, as it were? You know, two legs on some people may be formidable, you know, but, you know, they don't convey all the destructive power, both civil and ecclesiastically, you know, that the image as it is presented in Daniel 7 presents. And so maybe I'll just stop here and just show you some of these standard overlays that, I guess, depict this. First of all, you know, some of these you've seen before in, you know, various Bible inserts and all that, but we just want to reemphasize some thoughts. What we present to you this morning is essentially Christadelphian teaching since 1848. That concept is not to be diminished in these days when we've had such nonsense as the harlot of Rome, Revelation 17 being, you know, Israel, as it were, presented to us through apostate teaching. The king of the north being Turkey, for example. In 1990, a lot of Christadelphians jumped on the king of the north being Saddam Hussein. So what we say this morning is consistent with what Christadelphians have believed since 1848. Of course, here's our standard representation of Nebuchadnezzar's image, and particularly we want to note and bring to your attention, of course, that, you know, the feet, the placement of the feet are very important. You know, we see, you know, 1 foot planted in the west and 1 foot planted in the east, and it speaks of the confederacy that will ultimately prevail in Ezekiel 38, only to, of course, you know, be destroyed, as it were. And you'll notice again in recent times in Christadelphian apostasy, you know, the 10 toes have been ascribed to Arabic kingdoms, which all I want to say is that that's been done and it's, you know, preposterous, so we won't say any more. And then we have this overlay with the beast of Daniel 7, as it were. And at the bottom, of course, it's fairly obvious about the first three, but at the bottom we have depicted as the fourth beast, you know, this image, and of course it has Romans by it. Well, if we look at this overlay, you know, you'll notice the thing has ten horns on it, and of course it's, you know, spewing out, you know, what we would consider to be maybe fiery, you know, breath, as it were. It's got pretty bad looking, you know, teeth there, and then what's not so evident, of course, are these nails, which, you know, obviously are of brass and, you know, not too. But one thing I like about this depiction, and it's very accurate, you'll notice the thing is like slinking, as it were. It's and not an erect beast. It's a beast that is crawling. In the depiction in Daniel 7, in verse 7, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly. The Chaldean word that's translated as dreadful has the meaning of to slink or to crawl, okay? To slink or to crawl. And, we derive from that not only this image here, but we also derive this concept. You know, we see sin in two manifestations in the Scriptures. You know, first in an individual sense, as it were, but then secondly in an institutional or political sense. And so when we go all the way back, of course, you know, to Genesis, we think of the serpent, okay, and of course, you know, cursed to crawl on its belly, to slink, as it were. And when we think of the serpent power, we think not only of the serpent power within, but we also think of the serpent power that is manifested in political institutions, and most notably in this political institution of Daniel's fourth beast. The description in Daniel 7, verse 7, does not describe an upright animal. And it's been suggested that it's representative of, or it hints of the crocodile, as it were. And there's a link in this imagery, this language here, with the dragon of the apocalypse. Because as you know, in the apocalypse, chapter 12, for example, dealing with Constantine, you know, we have presented the image of the dragon power. Now, in the seventh account, in addition to this description, in verse 7, it continues. You'll note it devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And we, point out that the 10 horns of this fourth beast have an assignment, as it were, to the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image in verse 2. Now you'll note in verse 8, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. And so we have a development, as it were, of this little horn. Well, we don't have the time to work out the entire aspect of this, but without saying, you know, this little horn is both ecclesiastical and civil in its import. The little horn, and as we see from information later on in the chapter, you know, represents the rise of the papacy and the rise of also, because it's not only a religious influence, but it's also a kingdom, as it were, the rise of the Holy Roman Empire. The chapter goes on, and we see, as it were, Daniel's fourth beast destroyed. And it's important to note and make a distinction in what occurs here, that when judgment from the Ancient of Days, when Yahweh judges the nations and this fourth beast, that it is destroyed. Verse 11, I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain. So the influence of this little horn that comes up is going to last until Yahweh destroys it in the time of the end. I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. And then in verse 12, as concerning the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time. It's important to look at this and understand what's occurring here in the kingdom of men, as it were. Daniel's fourth beast will be destroyed, but the national identity of other constituent parts of the fourth beast over which it had power will be maintained. So, for example, we read about Egypt and Assyria in Isaiah, you know, that they'll be part of the kingdom age and that they'll be a heritage unto Yahweh. So even though, you know, we speak of Assyria and we know that Assyria is represented by Russia as a latter-day Assyrian, yet the Assyrian people will be maintained, as it were, and also the Egyptians, as an identity, a national identity in the millennial age. Brother Thomas interprets verse 12, the season and a time, as 1,000 years, and particularly the 1,000 years of the millennial age. Now, as we read this morning already, Daniel was pretty disturbed by this image, but he was really disturbed by this fourth beast, as it were. He wanted to understand more. In verse 19, then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, breaking pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. And he's given more information, of course, about this. In verse 23, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings, that shall arise, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings, and he shall speak great words, and it reads here, against the Most High. The translation would probably be better, concerning the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. It's very clear, of course, that this little horn represents the papacy as well as the effect of the Roman, the Holy Roman Empire, as it were. I want to emphasize this overlay. This overlay is a depiction, as it were, of the Germanic kingdoms about 526. And, you know, we can see the influence, as it were, you know, throughout the area of, you know, our interest here. And it's important, I think, to understand this German element, because of the fact that in the time of the end, when we see the Confederacy in Ezekiel 38, you know, we're concerned there with Gog and Magog, okay? And there's been Christadelphian confusion over Magog. But Brother Thomas identifies Magog as Germany, as it were. And we see in the history of Russia and Germany, as it were, a close association. And so the German influence and continuance of the Roman Empire, or of Daniel's fourth beast in a different manifestation, is very important to consider. So we will not go through the history and the time allotted to us this morning, but we understand, of course, that there's a concurrent development with these German empires with what was become known as the Holy Roman Empire and also the Roman Catholic Church, as it were. So, for example, that data, that display was in the 500s. Justinian proclaimed the Bishop of Rome as universal bishop over all Christians in 533. In 549 through 554, the Pragmatic Sanctions gave a legal code, and the Pope gained municipal and provincial control. So we see the Pope starting out merely as a religious entity, and then by the middle part, by 549 to 554, the Pope then becomes a civil authority, and he thus becomes as much political as he does ecclesiastical. Focus in that time period confirmed the decree of Justinian and proclaimed the Pope as head of all the churches. And then in the ensuing years, up to the point in time in the year 800 when Charlemagne was crowned as emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, we see the continuing development of the papacy, and then we see the interaction of these German-influenced leaders, as it were, to achieve what they wanted to achieve politically through interaction with the association with the Pope. In 732, Charles Martel defeated the Moslems. His son Pepin was crowned king by the grace of God. And it was claimed then that any who opposed such a king as Pepin opposed God, because the Pope was the representative of God on earth. And, of course, the Pope was working hand in hand with Pepin. Pepin provided the papacy with the military power it had lost from the Eastern emperors at Constantinople when, the kingdom, the Roman Empire, was split in two. In 756, Pepin donated territories of Ravenna, of Lombards in Rome, and formed, therefore, what was known as the Papal State. So we see the development, as it were, of, three kingdoms transferred into an ecclesiastical kingdom. And then in the year 800, Charlemagne was crowned, and we see him crowned as emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. He took upon himself the title Augustus, and he was the emperor of, in their words, the Germanic nation. The Germanic nation. Now, this fourth beast, corresponding to the legs, the Roman legs, we say that this fourth beast continues until the end of time. Well, I want you to consider this from historian, not Christadelphian, but the legacy of Rome. And then when you think of the kingdom of men today that we exist in, think of the influence of Rome upon all of us. And then pay particular attention to what this gentleman says about the religious aspect of Rome. This is from a college world history text, The Legacy of Rome. And I quote, "The most remarkable feature of Rome was not in its decline, but the fact that it lasted for 1,000 years. As a political institution, the Roman Empire ceased to exist in the West some 1,500 years ago. In the East, however, the empire lived on to become the medieval Byzantine Empire, a new institution, but one that always bore the marks of its Roman origins." So even though the kingdom was divided in two, even though two legs, yet each leg is clearly Rome, regardless of the geographical difference and the fact that they were ruled by separate, rulers, as it were. Each bore the marks of its Roman origins. And in the West, Roman civilization never died. The language of Rome, like the Roman law, has been of paramount importance in shaping the civilization of the Latin countries. Latin is the direct ancestor of the Romance languages, French, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, and Romanian. Modern English has derived much more from Latin than is commonly realized. The Christian society of the Middle Ages owed a great deal to Rome. Now think about that when we think about the history of the Catholic Church during the Middle Ages that had, you know, prominence, ruled the whole situation, told people what they could read and what they couldn't read, forbade the use of the scriptures by the common man, etc. But it mistrusted Roman materialism and utilitarianism. With the waning of the Middle Ages, men's interest shifted away from the hereafter and back to the physical world. And if that was true at the end of the Middle Ages, what about today? The men of the Renaissance again admired the Roman style with its concern for the practical and its taste for comfort and luxury. And its taste, the Roman taste for comfort and luxury. I would say that's a salient feature of the kingdom of men today. Finally, the one world created by Rome, the one world created by Rome, had aroused, we could say, the kingdom of men created by Rome, the one world. Created by Rome has aroused nostalgia for almost 20 centuries. Later generations, living in an unstable and divided world, idealized the Roman Empire as the golden age of peace and prosperity. Whenever men have faced the problems of a universal organization, they have studied the Pax Romana and the forces that made it possible. Perhaps the highest tribute ever paid to the practical genius of Rome is the fact that Roman foundation of law, language, and organization still support the oldest major institution in the Western world, the Roman Catholic Church. Now, that's from a college history thing, you know, and how true it is. So we can see then that not only Roman influence has continued throughout the centuries in language and law, customs, an affinity for materialism, an affinity for political stability, as it were, but also it has continued in the Roman Catholic Church, which is perhaps the highest example of the institutional characteristics of the Roman Empire. Now, what we have to also consider is that beyond Daniel 7, the history of this fourth beast is carried on by the scriptures. If this kingdom continues until the end of Gentile times, until when the judgment sits, then the history, of course, continues on. And so the student of Scripture must go to the apocalypse, as it were, to study the continuance of the Roman Empire or the Roman influence, Daniel's fourth beast. In fact, much of the apocalypse is an elaboration on Daniel's fourth beast. Daniel was not revealed much about the fourth beast. And we know at the end of the book of Daniel, when in chapter 12, you know, we're told that things were not revealed to Daniel, that the book was sealed, as it were. And then when we go to the fifth chapter of the Apocalypse, and we see that we see John, lamenting about the scroll that is available, and who is worthy to unseal the scroll to reveal the contents therein. And of course we find that, in the Apocalypse, that the Lion of Judah is the one worthy to unseal the scroll and reveal the contents therein. And then in the contents of the Apocalypse, we have the further elaboration of Daniel's fourth beast. And there's detail in Daniel's fourth beast that we don't have, again, in the apocalypse that we don't have in Daniel. These details provide information concerning the fourth beast in different manifestations, because through history it changed. It changed in its look. It changed in the people that ruled it. It changed in what it did. But yet it was still the same fourth beast. So, for example, when we go to the 13th chapter of the Apocalypse, you know, Brother Thomas in Eureka tells us right off the bat, in this 13th chapter, we have presented to us Daniel's fourth beast under the analytic symbols of the dragon, the beast of the sea, the beast of the earth, and the image of the beast. So he presents us with four manifestations, if you will, of the same fourth beast, but only a different time period and, of course, different information about what was to pertain unto it. And then, of course, when we get to Apocalypse 17, we have also another element that, is given along with also, the Apocalypse chapter 12, and that's the aspect of the heads, the eight heads. You know, we have 10 horns, but the image also had heads, and the heads were representative of various forms of government, you know, both pagan as well as later imperial Christian, if you will, under Constantine. And Brother Thomas informs us in Eureka, you know, that Daniel was never told about or never informed about the eight heads, as it were. Okay, Daniel only saw the manifestation of the beast with respect to the 10 horns. And so then the Apocalypse gives us information, concerning the heads of the fourth beast. And so the information that we're given carries us with an understanding of this fourth beast until our very own day. Our very own day. Now, if we had much time to devote to this subject, one thing that we would do is that we would emphasize the Germanic influence, as it were, not only upon Europe, which we saw in that overlay of those 10 kingdoms, but we would also outline to you the Germanic influence on Russia. It is often thought that Russia was settled by Scandinavian and Germanic settlers or invaders. So Russia, in other words, holds its ancient heritage, as it were, to a Scandinavian and Germanic influence. And so there is just, in history perhaps, a real relationship between Gog and Magog, which of course continues today, and it's rather interesting that Putin, speaks German fluently, and Germany was his sphere of influence when he was in the KGB in his Secret Service days. But notwithstanding, if you go through history, there is a case to be made that the Russians were influenced derived from Germanic and Scandinavian stock in old times. The difficulty of proving this, of course, is because of the lack of written history amongst the Russians. What is also equally clear, though, is that the Russians owe a lot of their cultural influence to the Eastern Roman Empire, which of course we know as Byzantium. And so the Byzantine influence, in fact, the entire Russian language, as it were, the Cyrillic alphabet, was given to them, by people that came from Byzantium and went into Russia and actually taught them a written language. A Mr. Obolensky wrote his name is Dmitry Obolensky, by the way, and he wrote this probably 30 or 40 years ago, a paper titled Russia's Byzantium Heritage. He points out that Byzantium brought to Russia five gifts: her religion, her law, her view of the world, her art, and writing. Okay, so we see the Eastern Roman Empire, you know, influencing Russia, as it were. And we know that when the Ottoman Turks took over the Eastern Empire in the year 1453, when Constantinople fell and became Istanbul, that influence moved north, as it were, into Russia. And Russia refers to Moscow as the Third Rome. As the Third Rome. That's been readily verifiable. Also, the Russian emperors began to refer to themselves as czars. And the term czar is a Russian derivation of the term Caesar, as it were. So there's a clear, you know, connection, as it were, with Rome and Russia. And there's a clear connection with Germany and Russia. And so the important thing to get from that is that Russia then continues the influence of the Roman Empire, and then in its latter day invasion of the Holy Land, as outlined both in Daniel chapter 11 and also Ezekiel 38 and 39, becomes a fitting, if you will, successor of the Roman dragon power, providing the military capability to be united with the Pope's ecclesiastical authority, in the West. Now, one of the things that's particularly truthful concerning the history of Rome and I guess the kingdom of men in general with respect to Gentiles is that they have always despised the things of God, and they particularly despised his chosen people, the Jews. You know, we see Roman Catholic persecution of the Jews during the Middle Ages. We've seen Russian persecution of the Jews. We've seen German persecution of the Jews. They've invaded the land, and of course with reason, as we know, and we'll address that later today, as it were. But it was Rome, of course, that did the work in bringing judgment upon, you know, a Judah that rejected the Messiah. And it's an interesting fact. I read in the last two or three years from an issue of Biblical Archaeology Review that the place outside of Jerusalem where Titus headquarters were in the Roman siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD is now occupied by a Russian site, as it were. How interesting that, you know, Russia today occupies the site. I can't remember what the purpose of it is, whether it's a consulate or whether it's an Orthodox, Russian Orthodox building or what have you. But the site is occupied by a Russian, authoritative institution. And it's the site of where Titus's headquarters originally were. I read that in Biblical Archaeology Review. That probably means nothing to them. It means everything to me, because I don't think it's coincidental that, you know, the dragon power that, brought Jerusalem to its knees in 70 AD will be associated with the same power that brings it to its knees, again, as it were. Well, there's a few more points I want to bring up before we close on this. One of the things I want to There's a lot of stuff that has occurred in the last several years, and particularly when I gave this class years ago. But this is back in 1998, you know. So this aspect of having a one world, and, you know, Roman in its source and so forth, this is a headline in 98, World Leaders Pledge to Build Undivided Europe at Summit. Well, that's pretty much now a fait accompli, with the exception of, a Europe without Britain. Here's one from 1999, and interesting in light of today's current events. Pope, Iranian president find common ground at meeting. Well, you know, we know that Persia is going to be confederate with Gomer and with Russia and Germany. And, you know, we know that the Vatican provides a spiritual alliance. So it's no mystery to us that the Pope and Persia will find things to have in common, or Iran. This was in 1999. Of course, this is already a done deal, too. We know that the Catholics are divided into East and West, Russian Orthodox or Greek Orthodox in the West. But we think that that's only a temporary obstacle that will, you know, soon be out of the way. Again, this occurred in 1999, where the Pope and the Orthodox Patriarch met, you know, and broke bread and had fellowship, found they have much in common. You know, we're sure that the Russian Orthodox will not provide an obstacle to the Russian being the dragon power. This is May 1999. Speaker notes escalating anti-Semitism in Russia, urges audience to act. Well, again, this aspect of Daniel's fourth beast being terrible, not only against the saints, but, you know, particularly against the Jews. I think we all understand about this being an ongoing thing. We probably should have Alexi here for these next two. This is a 1992 cartoon from, you know, this magazine, Ruskoy Vos, whatever. My southern Russian is not very good. But, you know, this is the heavily anti-Semitic faction in Russia, and they portrayed Yeltsin and Gorbachev as the running dogs of the Jewish devil. The caption reads, "Shame on the intelligentsia which has betrayed the people." So again, you know, they subscribe to the, you know, the old Russian protocols of Zion, bunk, you know, that the Jews are out, you know, themselves to conquer the world and take over the world's economy and so forth. But we see in things like this a fitting depiction of the anti-Semitism of the Russian people. Not all of the Russian people, but a number of the Russian people, you know, against the Jews, as it were. And here's kind of more of the same. The top one, an anti-Semitic cartoon that's from the same magazine. The caption reads, "Get these reptiles out so they don't foul our country." And then the bottom one, another anti-Semitic diatribe, this one on Jewish immigration from Russia. "A no to the racial incitement," reads the caption. And just like the Nazis during, you know, the 30s and the 40s, you know, the depiction is, of course, to make the Jews seem very, unwholesome and presents the Jews in a very negative manner. Well, you know, this will be the kind of people that will invade as we know, in Ezekiel 38 and 39. There's a lot that can be said about the development of Russia, the influence of the Eastern Roman Empire, and the German influence also upon Russia, which obviously we don't, you know, have time to, go into this morning. I guess what we would like to conclude with, though, is again something for you to think about, and that is this: there's usually also, if you will, a symmetry to the scriptures. Okay, a symmetry. In 70 A.D. we had a judgment on the Jews, but in the coming time period, we'll have a judgment on the Jews, but more importantly, a judgment on Gentiles, as it were. And we can see a lot of things in the scriptures in symmetry. And I want you to think about, this symmetry and the order that it occurs in. In the first century, with the return of the Lord, we had, as it were, a victory over the serpent, okay? But this victory over the serpent was in an individual form, the crucifixion of our Lord, and the serpent nature, if you will, that we all bear. So we would say this first act in this overview of the divine drama is victory over the serpent. Act number two, the glory departed to the east. We know that Christ was on earth, for a short period after his crucifixion, seen of his disciples. And then, of course, he went to the east of Jerusalem, and then he ascended into heaven. So the glory as it was, and this is depicted as it was in Ezekiel, those of you who have studied Ezekiel. After his ascension, Act 3 comes, which is the Roman power judgment on Israel. Yahweh, using Daniel's fourth beast, brings judgment to a faithless generation of Israel, which then brings Act 4. Jews were scattered from the land. Many Jews were destroyed, but the remainder were scattered from the land. Then we see a reversal of this process. Act 5, we see the Jews gathered to the land, and we've seen that over the last several years. But then we will see the Roman power judgment on Israel again. The Roman dragon power judgment on Israel again. So the sixth stage, was like, as it were, unto the third. Then we will see the glory return from the east. Christ and the saints, the kings of the sun's rising, as depicted in Apocalypse chapter 16, and also as depicted in Psalm 24 and Psalm 15, comes to cleanse the holy city from the invader that has pitched his tents between the seas. And then the final act, of course, is judgment on the dragon power. So if you will, and this time it's judgment on the dragon power in an institutional sense, whereas the victory over the serpent around, 33 A.D. or earlier, if you use a different time schedule, the judgment over the serpent becomes, as it were, institutional and political, as opposed to, the individual victory over the serpent nature, as it were. So we will conclude there. Unfortunately, the time constraints eliminates a lot of consideration, but hopefully you will have gotten somewhat of a depiction of the history and nature of Daniel's fourth beast. And with a sharing of these cartoons and you know, the other information that you know from history, you know, you can indeed understand why Daniel, even the little bit that he was permitted to see, understood it as being a very, you know, dreadful and fearful institution. Thank you.